Dominique, what a marvelous way to begin. And I just myself have to begin by saying what an honor it is to be here. I'm so pleased that John and his colleagues here at the Terra thought of me to come into conversation with you, because I think that the exhibition that you and your colleagues have organized at the Louvre is really a new way for museums to think about the way in which their collections can be brought into conversation with one another to drive forward our own sense of responsibility to our cultures and to the world. And this is such an extraordinary exhibition. For those who have not yet had the chance to see it, you really must go, because it is one of the broadest ranging human discussions across time and place that I've ever experienced, and of course done in a way that only the Louvre and several other institutions in the world would be able to do it.
Thank you.
And it's a tour de force, but it's an important project, and I have learned so much from it.
Thank
it
you.
Was such a pleasure to be in it with you.
Thank you.
I have my remarks are a little more formal, so forgive me. For those who are not native English speakers, I apologize for not being able to speak with any sophistication in French. And so I will try to read slowly but with some expression so that it's understandable. And I think we're set to go. You also will find that I was very moved by the relationship between Ai Weiwei's work and Cole's. It is an extraordinary conversation that's been set up, and I'm delighted that Dominique has, in a sense, set that up for me. In considering the premise of the exhibition, A Brief History of the Future, and the way in which Cole's work is situated, I found myself contemplating Jacques Attali's concept of the universality of art and how Dominique and her colleagues explore this idea, focusing on the ways in which museums necessarily segregate works from their own cultural and historical contexts to present them for scrutiny both on their own and in juxtaposition with works by other artists, at times from different cultures and other times, for the purpose of understanding the broader nature of our species and the astounding range of ways in which we face the challenge of our existence. The dialogue across the exhibition between Cole's Course of Empire, which appears at the heart of the project in a section entitled Historical Cycles, and Ai Weiwei's Foundation, which appears toward the end in a section called And Today, is particularly potent, bringing Cole's series painted from 1833 to 1836 during an early period of America's intensive national expansion into conversation with a new work commissioned for the exhibition by one of the most thoughtful contemporary commentators on China's explosive reemergence as an economic and cultural power of enormous international influence in our own time. Cole's series, met first by the visitor to the exhibition, surveys five stages of empire from, as we've learned from Dominique, what the artist calls the savage state, through a pastoral stage in which human society balances harmonically with the natural world, the decadent heights of empire characterized by greed and lasciviousness, the inevitable destruction of culture made weak by its excesses, and finally a state of desolation, one in which the remains of empire are reclaimed by nature, but which stands as a warning to the viewer as to the inevitable fate of a society that stretches beyond the pastoral ideal. Ai Weiwei's work, encountered toward the end of the exhibition, suggestively recalls Cole's series, again focusing attention on the remains of a past civilization evoked by the masked bases of ancient Chinese columns and inviting the viewer to contemplate not only the foundation stones of a powerful civilization lost in time, but also to stand upon those stones to build a new and better society that might be sustained more successfully into the future. Like Cole's work, Ai Weiwei's own is universally accessible in the context of this exhibition, but it gains power as a work that stands in a long history of the artist's productions, which have served as a continuous critique of his own nation as it makes an enormous shift in its economic system and slowly and tentatively lifts its repressive stance toward an open dialogue about the kind of society that should emerge through this transition. In her superb discussion of the work in the exhibition's catalog, Sandra Adam Corlay tells us that Ai Weiwei interprets the space he has created, as Dominique has told us, as a forum, making possible the grand debates through which the future can be envisioned. She notes, and I quote, that he proposes that each visitor to the exhibition should ascend the bases of the ancient columns, considering them like the ruins of a lost harmony, and making of them the foundations of a future defined by possibility. Thus, he makes evident the power of the individual word, exalts freedom of thought, and suggests the force of freedom of action. As Barbara Galati makes clear, and I should say that Barbara is here, and it's such an honor to have her in the audience today because there's no one who knows Cole better than she does. As she makes clear in her superb catalog essay on Cole's Course of Empire, the artist's contemporaries were not inclined to read his series as a commentary on the rapidly developing empire of the United States, extending west under the presidency of Andrew Jackson, but as a critique of what were conceived as the corrupt states of Europe, which had risen and fallen successively from the time of ancient Greece and Rome. Based on a fresh reading of Roman republicanism, the young United States seemed shielded from the cyclical pattern of development and dissipation, both by its revolutionary break with Britain and by the vast distance afforded by the Atlantic Ocean, which promised it a brighter future. Indeed, as a masterpiece dissociated from the particulars of the time in which Cole painted his series, the cycle sustains its power in the current exhibition, and we can appreciate the work as speaking generally about the fate of all societies that fall prey to the avaricious interests and demagogic power mongering, and even more generally, as Barbara has suggested, as a poignant examination of the mutability of all things human. Galati stresses that it is exactly the openness of this magnificent work, the lack of necessity to see it as tied to one set of time-bound meanings, that has allowed the cycle to become such an icon of American art, serving as inspiration for artists across almost two centuries in the United States itself, who have used it as a springboard to explore and to critique the art of development that characterizes human society at any point in time. And I think it's so eloquent in its discourse that to see an artist like Ai Weiwei gravitate toward it and to begin to explore both the past of his own society and the future that it holds is an international dialogue of enormous importance, and the exhibition has a potency in that way. Nonetheless, coming to understand the particular incentives that drove Cole to create this work, contextualizing it again in its moment, does lend the cycle the full power of its import. And Cole's own drive to create the work should be examined as underpinning the more general associations that can be drawn by its viewers who encounter it with this special knowledge. As Galati notes, Angela Miller has interpreted Cole's own incentives for the creation of the series as grounded in his personal antipathy towards what he saw as the development of a rapacious industrial empire, which exploited poor workers for the profit of the few, arguing instead for a conservative agrarianism that might offer what Cole understood to be the greater stability of a pastoral society. Miller credits Cole's attitude to the specificity of his own circumstances. Having emigrated with his own family as a child from the industrial north of England to seek a better life, he watched his father struggle vainly to find a toehold on the merciless wheel of an industrial young nation. This harsh experience underlay Cole's pessimism toward the notion of progress embraced by Jacksonian Democrats, a party comprised, as Miller tells us, of a shifting alliance of Western farmers, Southern slaveholders, and small businessmen along the Eastern seaboard. She notes, and I quote, "The Democratic Party embodied almost everything that Cole feared, commerce, partisanship, and materialism. Cole was especially critical of the myth of progress that underpinned Jacksonian optimism and justified westward expansion. Like many of his patrons, he favored a political deference, one in which an educated elite exercised a form of benevolent stewardship over others. He feared the vulgarity and ignorance of the mass of men, and he saw the popularity of Jackson, who Cole regarded as nothing more than a demagogue, as proof of his fears." Miller understands the red-robed figure presiding over the triumphal procession in the left foreground of the third canvas entitled Consummation of Empire as Cole's interpretation of Jackson himself, surrounded, as Cole wrote, by captives on foot and a numerous train of guards, senators, and so forth. And you can see this little figure, I'll just point him out here, right here with this procession that goes before him. Angela calls him Cole Caesar. In point of fact, I think probably Cole was thinking of Augustus from Gibbon, more accurately, but the point, I think, is taken as an important one. As Cole's emperor, Jackson embodied in Miller's world all that can go wrong in society when wealth and status replace the simpler virtues seen in the previous canvas, the pastoral state, which you see on the left. Democracy turns into demagoguery as a reverence for nature, the central theme of this previous canvas, and it degenerates into a worship of power and empire. As Miller concludes, Cole's series was, and I quote, not about nature, but politics. And his Course of Empire, as she says, represents his effort to reinvent landscape art as a model of moral critique. It is with some irony that while Cole's notion of the virtuous society might have been linked with pastoral concept of the beautiful as developed by the 18th century Anglo-Irish philosopher Edmund Burke, many American landscape painters who were his heirs, would associate the finest attributes of American culture with Burke's and ultimately Kant's concept of the moral sublime. As the nation propelled itself forward along the lines of progress abhorred by Cole, the grandeur and enormity of the landscape would come to represent the ambitions of the young nation as a Christian society, sweeping west to fulfill its manifest destiny. You see on your right, for example, Albert Bierstadt's enormous painting of Lander's Peak in the Wind River Range of the Rocky Mountains, in what is now the state of Wyoming. Bierstadt began to contemplate the creation of large-scale panoramic paintings of the American West in the late 1850s, as development of the Western territories began to accelerate, and public interest in the as-yet unportrayed landscape promised financial success. This enormous work, measuring over 73.5 by 120.75 inches and completed in 1863, resulted from his first trip with a government survey expedition to what was then the Nebraska Territory in 1859, and is a work that speaks to the course of empire in its own terms. The painting, which met with enormous popular success, invites the viewer peacefully into a tranquil foreground, occupied by Native American peoples in seeming harmony with the landscape, at the same time that it confronts the viewer with the sweeping peaks of the Grand Tetons, an inspiring challenge to scale in the quest towards the occupation of the West. Perhaps the most overt painting in the spirit of manifest destiny, one quite distant from Cole's own valuation of the pastoral ideal, is Thomas Moran's Mountain of the Holy Cross, which you see here. Moran had served as an artist on a federal geological survey led by Ferdinand Van Devere Hayden in 1871 to the Yellowstone region of Wyoming. And in that year, his Trinarian watercolors of the extraordinary geological features of the park, along with photographs by William Henry Jackson, had moved Congress to create the first national park, setting aside the region as a recreational space meant to inspire an appreciation of pristine wilderness in a landscape already doomed by the specter of commercial development. Moran returned to the Rocky Mountain regions with Hayden in 1873, where he was among the first to see a peak that came to be known as the Mountain of the Holy Cross because of the naturally occurring pattern of snow that formed the sign. And I think if you look to the campus on the right, you'll see at the very top the peak of this mountain with its snow embedded in crevices in this characteristic pattern of the cross. This cross was considered a spiritual beacon, signaling the pursuit of empire as a God-given cause, and Moran created a painting that stressed the sublime power of the landscape, adding wildly cascading falls that tumble across the fallen boulders and broken trees in the foreground and disappear at the feet of the viewer, who has been invited to stand on a rock outcropping just where the water descends dramatically over a cliff. Moran's vast landscapes, such as this one, which often are monumental in scale, were intended to stimulate the greatest appreciation for nature, but they were tied to a project that had as its aim both the mastery over and exploitation of the resources of the region of the West that he was exploring. And the boundless had an end in his work, in the work of the surveys themselves. Ultimately, the harmonic relationship so valued by Cole between human beings and the natural world gave way in Moran's work to the imperatives of westward expansion and empire. Cole might have been discouraged to learn that the course of empire that he painted during an early phase of Western development would in fact prove, and I think to a certain extent it is true, prophetic. I think he already knew what was transpiring, and it wasn't difficult to read the way in which this industrializing nation was going to begin to proceed in very serious terms across the continent. Over almost two centuries, the American West has been marked by settlement, and its resources have been thoroughly pillaged, not only for an industrializing nation, but for an industrializing world. Mm. The small bits of so-called wilderness set across the nation to preserve a vestige of the vast terrain, once inhabited by only small populations of Native American peoples, are now managed lands, carefully tended and controlled, to keep as many indigenous species as possible in balance and reminding equally managed visitors of the glorious natural environment that only a short time in the past characterized much of the continent. It is in this context that the National Museum of Wildlife Art came to install Ai Weiwei's Circle of Animals, Zodiac Heads, on a ridge overlooking the broad valley of Jackson, Wyoming, just last summer. Cole's anxiety over empire and a loss of balance between humankind and nature is implicit in this conjunction of the Chinese artist's first public work critiquing empire and the landscape that it surveys in this particular arena. For an American audience, the work set against the sweeping westward backdrop cannot help but conjure the Chinese laborers who were indentured to perform the backbreaking work of building the railroads that crossed the West to settlement. And you can see here an anonymous photograph of Chinese railroad workers from 1865 and Avery Russell's East and West shaking hands at the laying of the last rail of the Transcontinental Railroad on May 10th of 1869 at Promontory Point, Utah. But the actual installation of Ai Weiwei's piece does far more, created by the curators and the artist himself at a very long distance, by the way, as a means to set his own concerns about China's sense of past in relation to the experience of empire against his nation's ambitions in the world today. The piece is positioned against the elk preserve that serves as a holding pen for the migrating herds that come down from the national parks of Yellowstone and Grand Teton in search of food during the harsh winter months. These great animals that once roamed freely across the western plains have been hemmed in by the vast ranches, industrial ranches, that now extend across the state. And having nowhere to forage, they would starve if they were not fed by the federal government. The ecological management of the herds has been complex and vexed. First wolves, which are their natural predators, and are despised by cattle ranchers who fear for their stock, were exterminated. Then, as elk populations became too large to support on the small preserve, wolves were reintroduced to help bring the populations down to a sustainable level. Bison, too, come down from the parklands in wintertime, but like the wolves, they are killed if they wander off federal lands because they carry brucellosis, known as undulant fever in humans, and ranchers fear this transmission of the disease to their herds. Balancing natural populations with agrarian interests is an immense ecological challenge, and one that Cole would have appreciated as he considered the transition from the Savage Tate to that of the Pastoral and finally to the Consummation. The contested backdrop also serves to heighten the power of Ai Weiwei's piece, a complex commentary on China's relationship to the empires of Europe as they emerged in the Renaissance, and by extension, a critique of China's own drive to power in the modern world. Ai Weiwei's piece reinterprets 12 bronze heads representing the traditional Chinese zodiac that once decorated the fountain clock of the Yuan Ming Yuan, an imperial retreat in Beijing. Designed in the 18th century, not by Chinese artists, but by two European Jesuits serving in the court of the Qing Dynasty Emperor Qing Long, the 12 heads originally functioned as a water clock fountain, which was sited in the European-style gardens of Yuanming Yuan. In 1860, the Yuanming Yuan was plundered by French and British troops, and the heads were pillaged. It's such an extraordinary irony. In reinterpreting these objects on a grand scale, Ai Weiwei focuses attention on questions of looting and repatriation, the complex ironies and absurdities of empire, involving, in this case, the creation of artworks in Chinese form by Western artists for a Chinese patron, which then were stolen by Western looters as Chinese objects for a Western market, and which now have been reappropriated by a Chinese artist for global consideration. They are fully examined here. The myth of pure national identity lies at the heart of Ai Weiwei's work, pressing those who consider the piece to recognize the truly hybrid nature of all nations and all peoples to question the nationalist agenda that underlies empire. Set against the fraught landscape of the Elk Preserve, one of the most contested pieces of land in America, these animal heads gain particular eloquence, insisting on a careful and considered future for China and all nations in light of the troubled history of empire and the imbalanced world it has left in its wake. Ai Weiwei's piece and the landscape it surveys resonate poignantly with the exchange created by the Louvre between Cole's course of empire and the Chinese Artists Foundation, reminding us of the power of museums to create conversations between and amongst works from different cultures and different places, different times, that illuminate our own situation and awaken us, one hopes, to a better future.